Today on Dana's Low Carb for Life, we talk about Easter leftovers, the best way to hard-boil an egg, we have the summer produce roundup, and more, so stick around. You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Hey, gang. Welcome to episode 14 of Dana's Low Carb for Life, brought to you by CarbSmart.com, your smart choice for a low-carb lifestyle. First of all, I have exciting news. At least I'm excited about it. Amazon.com is now listing 315-minute low-carb recipes as available. We'll put up a link at the show page, and I hope you all order. Yes, I feel that every single one of you needs this book, and your mom needs this book, and your sister needs this book, your brother-in-law needs this book, your babysitter needs this book. Come on, order a dozen. Be aware, though, that this is a reissue of the original 15-minute low-carb recipes with 50% new material. In other words, it has the original 200 recipes plus 100 new ones. So if you don't have the original 15-minute low-carb recipes, you are certainly going to want the new 300 recipe book. If you do have the original, I sure hope you consider 100 new recipes from me worth buying the new book for. As I record this, it's the very beginning of Passover 2011, and I'd like to wish a very happy Passover to all of our Jewish listeners. May it be full of love and laughter and family and not too many carbs. I'd like, too, to take this opportunity to direct you to friendswithdiabetes.org. That's friendswithdiabetes.org. It is not a .com, it is a .org. It's a website for Jews who are keeping kosher while low-carbing to control diabetes. It is a terrific resource. We'll put up a link on the show page. They also publish an excellent magazine you may want to subscribe to. And I'd like right now to offer my thanks to Rabbi Hirsch Meisels of Friends with Diabetes for his help and his friendship over the years. It is also, of course, getting on toward Easter. Funny how Easter and Passover tend to go together. Since I've already covered Easter candy in a previous episode of this podcast, I thought I'd talk a little bit about using up the Easter leftovers. Now, I'm figuring that a whole lot of you are going to have leftover ham. Just a few of you may have leftover lamb. That's my favorite, but I've learned that overwhelmingly most people eat ham. And just about everyone who celebrates Easter is going to have some hard-boiled eggs on hand. So I thought that this, too, would be an ideal time to clue you in on my very best egg hard boiling technique. This is a skill that will serve you well all year round, not just at Easter. So you're going to want to hear that regardless of whether you celebrate Easter or not. I will tell you a really important part of the egg hard boiling trick right here. You do not want to use strictly fresh eggs for hard boiling. You want them to be a little bit stale. So if you're going to be hard boiling eggs this weekend, this coming weekend, run out and buy them right now. Put this podcast on hold, get in your car, go to the grocery store and go buy the eggs, stash them in the fridge to age until the weekend. And in fact, you might even want to check the expiration dates on the eggs at the grocery store and choose the oldest cartons. I know this sounds crazy, but for hard boiled, the staler eggs are the best thing, as I will explain later in this podcast. You'll want to hear that. Also, several episodes back, I told you about my visit to a new doctor who diagnosed me with an atypical case of PCOS, one of the most serious carbohydrate intolerance, insulin-driven diseases. I thought I'd give you an update on that, and also another health issue that he told me about at that initial meeting that I haven't shared with you because I didn't think it was apropos of this podcast, but it's turning out to have some more far-reaching implications than I thought. Actually, that's an understatement. So I'll be telling you about that. And of course, we're going to have another episode of Low Carb Voices, my favorite part of the podcast. Specifically, we're going to be talking about some summer produce favorites. All of that's coming up, so stick around. First of all, let me give you an update on my adventures in PCOS land. As you may or may not recall, in episode 7 of this podcast, I talked about my first visit to a new doctor, Dr. Matt Andry, and the fact that he had diagnosed me with an atypical case of polycystic ovarian syndrome. He said that my insulin levels were still too high. I asked how that was happening to me when I generally stay under 30 grams of carb per day. He said that I had been controlling it pretty successfully all these years with my low-carb diet, but that it had to do with high cortisol levels at night that were triggering my liver to create excess sugar while I was sleeping through the process known as hepatic gluconeogenesis. That's the process that means that you really don't need to eat any carbs at all in order to have enough glucose in your bloodstream. Well, I knew I ran high cortisol levels at night. I've had insomnia all of my life. I was finally diagnosed with a circadian rhythm disorder, which is called a delayed sleep phase syndrome, about 7 or 8 years ago. My body has difficulty figuring out the difference between day and night. Hormone tests have shown that my cortisol, the stress hormone level, starts to rise at bedtime instead of falling as it should. Theoretically, your cortisol should start to rise a little while before you wake up, and it is the rising level of cortisol that tells your body that it's time to wake up, and falling levels of cortisol that tell your body it's time to go to sleep. Unfortunately, mine tend to go up at bedtime, and this is the cause of my insomnia. My body swaps day and night. Well, it turns out that these high cortisol levels are also the cause of my elevated fasting blood glucose. Dr. Andrey put me on metformin, which is a very old school diabetes medication that works by improving insulin sensitivity and also by reducing that hepatic gluconeogenesis, that glucose production in the liver. I knew from reading the Atkins Diabetes Solution that metformin was the only blood sugar lowering drug that Dr. Atkins used and the only one that Dr. Mary Vernon and Jackie Eberstein recommend. It's just about the only blood sugar lowering drug that does not cause weight gain, which is the reason Dr. Atkins used it. And indeed, metformin often causes weight loss. I can't say I've lost a ton of weight since I've been on it, but it has been easier to keep the weight off. So I started on the metformin. I am here to tell you this was not the easiest thing I ever did. Metformin is notoriously hard on the gut. I have always had a very steady stomach. I've never had motion sickness. I've never been prone to, feeling queasy over food, nothing like that. And suddenly I was having a queasy stomach at odd times. I was lying awake sometimes with gut cramps at night. I even occasionally had bouts of having to run suddenly to the bathroom several times in an hour. This was not fun. Well, I stuck it out with the metformin, slowly increasing my dose because, frankly, few things scare me quite the way that high blood sugar does. That stuff rots you from the inside out. Sugar ages you like nothing else. And I am determined to lick this thing. Although Jackie Eberstein, by the way, if you don't know who Jackie is, Jackie was Dr. Atkins' right-hand woman and clinic manager for, 40 years. And she's wonderful. I've been lucky enough to get to know her on the low-carb cruises. And she was kind enough to give me some info and advice. And she tells me that part of my problem, part of the reason I'm no longer able to successfully control this with diet alone, is that approaching menopause just messes up hormone levels, including making blood sugar control much harder. I assume that's why, after all these years, diet alone isn't sufficient. Although, I hasten to emphasize that while my morning fasting blood glucose runs a little high, my A1C, the measure of blood sugar over time, has always come up stone normal. I am not diabetic. I am not running high sugar levels all day long. It's just from my liver making it. My diet is not raising my blood sugar almost at all. But I have been holding out on you because I was unaware of just how intertwined all my various health issues were. You see, on that first visit, Dr. Andrey gave me a second diagnosis. He told me I have attention deficit disorder. I had wondered off and on from time to time if I might have ADD. Dr. Andrey pegged me right off in that first visit. I think he talked to me for 20 minutes before he said, "Has anybody ever told you you have ADD?" Humorously enough, when I told my brother that a new doctor had diagnosed me with ADD, he laughed and said, "I hope you didn't pay for that diagnosis. That's like me paying a doctor to tell me I'm bald." Now that I've spent a few weeks reading up on ADD, he's absolutely right. It is glaring that I have ADD. I am, and always have been, looking back, a textbook case of what is known as inattentive ADD. If I were a kid now, I would have been diagnosed years ago. But when I was a kid, the term attention deficit disorder hadn't even been coined. I was just an underachiever, unfocused. Well, I bring this up not to bore you with my problem giving me PCOS, are all part and parcel of my attention deficit disorder. And that means basically everything that is wrong with my health is due to the ADD. I'm also hypothyroid, as was my mother. Well, guess what? Iodine deficiency, which is one of the main causes of hypothyroidism, dramatically increases a mother's risk of giving birth to a child with attention deficit disorder. I get major seasonal affective disorder. Again, this is far more common in people with attention deficit disorder. And by the way, seasonal affective disorder in many people causes severe carbohydrate cravings. I have rapidly come to think of my carbohydrate intolerance, my sleep disorder, my hypothyroidism, my seasonal affective disorder, and my attention deficit disorder, not as different conditions, but as aspects of the same thing. It's all one thing. And now that my eyes have been opened and I understand that it's all one thing, I'm hoping to find ways to deal with the fundamental problem rather than continually attacking the various symptoms. Which is why I was interested when Dr. Andrews suggested a relatively new medication called Cyclocet. Cyclocet is interesting because it works by improving circadian rhythms. It lowers blood glucose by improving circadian rhythms. That's why the cyclo in the name, it improves your cycle. You take Cyclocet once a day, first thing in the morning, and it causes a burst of dopamine in the brain, which is the chemical my brain is short on. That's the wide awake feel good chemical. And that tells your body that it's time to be awake. And that sets the body up to be properly awake during the day, thus leading to lower cortisol in the evening and therefore improved sleep and a lessening of that hepatic glucose production overnight. By the way, Cyclocet is also in that small group of blood sugar medications that does not cause weight gain and often causes weight loss. The morning after my first dose of Cyclocet, my fasting blood sugar was stone normal. I was really excited. However, it was not all smooth sailing. The next day, I had a nasty reaction to the Cyclocet. I had a racing heart and dyspnea, which is shortness of breath. I wound up going to the emergency room more out of caution than anything else. I was fine, but it was scary and expensive to go to the emergency room. And I was also very, very disappointed because I've been so excited about the potential for treating the underlying condition of low dopamine in the brain rather than the various symptoms. But I talked to Dr. Andre. He said not to go off the Cyclocet, that I was simply having a side effect due to having too high a dose too quickly, and that I should drop my dosage from one tablet per day to a quarter tablet. Now, the possible recommended dose of Cyclocet goes from one tablet per day to eight tablets per day. But